crossing the border to go to school today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Many of the students who attend a local high school in El Paso, Texas, start their day in Mexico. Usually their morning commute involves waiting up to an hour and a half to cross the border.
But nowadays, since things got a little bit crazy, we're waiting like from 2 to 3 hours.
That's after President Trump threatened to shut down the border. Trump now says that won't happen anytime soon, but school officials in El Paso aren't taking any chances.
We've got a plan because the present administration is very unpredictable.
How one Texas school and its students are coping with uncertainty at the border. That story and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Good to have you with us this Thursday. A whole lot of uncertainty about the U.S. southern border right now. A few days ago, President Trump was threatening to shut it down. Today, after pushback from lawmakers on both sides of the aisle, he backed off. Trump now says he's giving Mexico 1 year to stop illegal drugs from coming into the U.S. Despite the president's comment today, the uncertainty along the U.S.-Mexico border continues, and it's affecting people there, especially people who cross the border daily, as we hear now from The World's Monica Campbell.
Let's start at 5:30 a.m., when Melissa Sanchez begins her day. She's 18 and a high school senior.
I prepare my things for coming to school. I set up everything, and then I make some breakfast to myself if I have the time, and then I leave my house like at 6:20, 6:30.
Sanchez lives in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, and walks across the border, the pedestrian bridge, with her mom to go to school in El Paso, Texas.
Then we got into the line to cross the border, and we wait like an hour or an hour and a half, usually. But nowadays, since things got a little bit crazy, we're waiting like from 2 to 3 hours, so I need to wake up more early.
The lines get longer because border agents who manage the crossings are being assigned elsewhere to respond to more migrants, mostly from Central America, wanting to enter the U.S. Many migrants are also lined up waiting on the same walkway Sanchez takes to school. I ask her, what's that like?
I think it's really sad to actually saw them just sitting and waiting them for like some kind of miracle happen to their lives, because I have the privilege to go to school, to have a family. They see those poor kids that they don't have a place to stay, and that's the only thing that can run into my mind.
She's seeing a humanitarian crisis up close as she heads to school. But her interaction with the migrants is very limited, no conversation. Eventually, Sanchez passes through to the U.S. side and gets to class.
I think we're 8 blocks from the crossing.
We're like 8 or 7. Yeah, it's not that much.
That's Socorro de Anda, who runs the school Sanchez attends. It's called the Lydia Patterson Institute. I'm speaking with them on the phone from the school, which is Methodist, private, and bilingual. And about 70% of its students trek in from Mexico every day. They carry student visas like Sanchez does, or U.S. passports. Some were born in the U.S., some in Mexico. Danda has been with the school for more than 30 years, but it's existed far longer than that.
The school has been here for 108 years, Monica. Generations of students have gone through here. We are here to create leaders for both sides of the border.
Melissa Sanchez says she wanted to study in the States ever since she was a kid.
My dream, since I can tell us as I was little, I wanted to come to college here. And also that I wanted to like to get to know more people, more cities, more countries.
She got a full scholarship, like a lot of students at the school. But now, the school has been preparing for possible border closures, even if they're temporary. Danda met with the students this week.
Told them not to worry about it. Said, you know, I don't want you worrying. I want you to worry about your schoolwork.
They've also got a backup plan, just in case.
We are ready to be able to transmit our classes via computers, if need be. And they can receive their classes there with their own computers or their tablets or even their cell phones. We've got a plan.
Danda doesn't think she'll need the backup plan, but she's anxious.
It all depends, you know, what kind of a dream I had last night. because the present administration is very unpredictable.
So it's affecting your sleep?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and not only me, but the whole city of El Paso, the whole city of Juarez, our parents, our students, I cannot see the border closing for too long a period of time. Frankly, I cannot. It would be disastrous to the state of Texas, and it would be disastrous to the whole country.
So far, despite the longer lines at the border, most students are making it to school every day. That impresses DeAnda.
I mean, the determination of this young kids is just incredible. I can tell you that much. Incredible.
And they're doing it on less sleep. Melissa Sanchez used to shoot for 7 hours a night. Lately, it's been more like 5.
It's really hard. It takes like to make a step up and say, okay, I need to do this.
And then she's out the door, crossing the border daily, like few high schoolers in America. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell.
There is also the fictional U.S.-Mexico border in the comic book imagination of Hector Rodriguez III. He's the creator of El Peso Hero. Volume 9 of the series is out now, and Rodriguez is drawing El Peso Hero in much more realistic border situations. This time, El Peso Hero is on a mission to rescue children from detention centers. Rodriguez, his creator, says that last summer, when the border crisis intensified, he decided he had to update the comic to reflect the new reality for a superhero.
We were trying to tell a story of the realities within the world of El Peso Hero, a little bit more darker. We had, or the original story had adults within the detention facilities. And I told my artist, you know, hey, you know, it needs to reflect the reality and have kids.
How do you make sure you are accurately reflecting their experiences, like the loneliness and sadness from being separated from family, for example, and just their lives in your comic?
You know, as an educator, you listen. You mean you're, as a great educator, you're a listener. And so you listen to your students, you listen to their parents, and you're involved in the community. And having a pulse has given me a good resource to make sure that their stories are represented respectfully. In this case, they feel very uplifting that there is a superhero within their own culture, their own language, that represents them in a very positive way.
Do your students read El Peso Hero, and what do they think about it?
They feel proud. They feel uplifted. They feel empowered. It's been a very positive effect. And you know, I've gone to recently. I was in Austin, Texas, visiting schools, and one of the students made a connection to one of the covers of El Peso Hero, where she was telling me a very sad story about her mom almost drowning crossing and how she really loved the cover that it's told her mom's story.
So for your students, what does El Peso Hero mean to them?
These kids progress through struggle. You know, it's a reflection of their own personal lives in the community. They do follow, you know, the latest Marvel movie and so on, but they never seen Spider-Man eat empanadas, you know, or enchiladas, you know, Mexico, right? And so they love seeing El Peso Hero, you know, reading that he's eating tortas, being part of their own world culture.
Hector, when you were growing up, what comics did you connect with?
Oh, gosh, I listen Spawn, Todd McFarlane's Spawn, you know, African-American vigilante hero. I like it. Connected to me because it was gritty and, you know, the border area is a cross-cultural bridge and there's a lot of grays.
You grew up along the border in Texas, yeah?
Right, along the border. You go past Texas, and as well as some Mexican historietas comics, you know, El Santo.
Did those comics kind of provide you with characters that, you know, your students today see in El Peso Hero?
You know, it kind of gave me a love for the craft more than anything else. You know, I guess a passion for their maybe one day being a more contemporary hero that spoke to the border culture.
I mean, one of the things I think that'll strike readers about your comic is the style it's in. It's kind of evokes old DC and Marvel comics from the 70s and 80s, but the hero is in pants and a T-shirt and cowboy boots. The only thing that kind of suggests he's a superhero is his gold Peso Hero belt buckle. Why clothe him that way and not the classic spandex and cape kind of thing?
Well, you know, there's actually a conversation in the beginning of issue one where El Peso Hero is being asked that same question. Well, aren't you afraid of reprisals? You know, you don't have a mask. You don't have a cape. Well, El Peso Hero answers back, well, capes are for games and masks are for cowards. And then so in this case, you know, anybody can dress up as a puzzle hero. Any their uncle could be a puzzle hero, you know, and especially speaks to the Southwest border culture, blue jeans, boots, you know, just every day.
Makes life easy on Halloween, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, on cosplay, too. So.
So as I said, El Peso Hero is now an established character with a storyline in Volume 9. What was the path to releasing Volume 1, and what kind of reaction did it get when it first came out?
Oh, El Peso Hero started as a webcomic just through its accessibility.
Right.
Summer 2012, making its runs through the conventions. It went viral in Mexico, South America, Italy, Spain, Canada. If you take away El Peso Hero's identity, being Latino, Mexican, Norteño, Spanish speaking, deep down you have a very universal story of somebody doing the best they can under extreme circumstances.
So where does El Peso Hero go from this point on? Like, will his exploits track the news, do you think?
Well, we'll see. You know, it's, I know that it's ever changing, but the realities are very profound in our community, Latinx community. It's a struggle, but you know, there's a lot of grit, a lot of perseverance in the community, and those are very important aspects that need to be shared.
Well, good luck continuing forward, Hector Rodriguez III, the man behind superhero El Peso Hero. Thanks very much. Great to speak with you.
Thank you so much.
El Peso Hero steps into action. We have panels from the latest volume at theworld.org. A quick update now on a bill passed by the House today in Washington. It's a resolution that requires President Trump to take the U.S. out of the war in Yemen. Both the House and the Senate are on the record in their opposition to U.S. involvement in the Yemen war. That involvement is in the form of U.S. military support for a coalition led by Saudi Arabia, which is directly involved in the conflict. The World's Stephen Snyder has been following the story.
2 weeks ago, the Senate passed a resolution that asked President Trump to end U.S. involvement in the civil war in Yemen. Today, the House had to approve the Senate language before it could be sent to the president. But first, there was a plot twist.
I rise today to offer a motion stating that it's in the national security interest of the United States to oppose a global movement to boycott the state of Israel.
Just before the vote, Texas Representative Michael McCaul offered a pro-Israel amendment to the resolution. If the House had agreed to the amendment, it would have sent the whole discussion back to the Senate for reconsideration. But the House chamber responded to McCaul right away.
All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say no. The noes have it.
So the House rejected the amendment and moved on to vote on the resolution itself. It calls for the U.S. to stop helping Saudi Arabia's Air Force pick military targets in Yemen. Those Saudi airstrikes have injured or killed thousands of Yemeni civilians.
The joint resolution is passed.
Now the resolution goes on to President Trump. He's expected to veto it. For The World, I'm Stephen Snyder.
Tattoos, henna, piercing, all forms of body art. These are art forms, but what if that art could also tell you where the person is from in the world? Ritual scarring is common in many African tribes, and soon it could help many African descendants figure out where their families came from. Researchers are delving into archives for clues, archives that some former colonial countries are struggling to maintain. Here's The World's Rupa Shenoy.
Abu Kuroma is the archivist in training at the National Archives of Sierra Leone. He'll remain the archivist in training until one of the two senior archivists retire.
Yeah, that is it. That is how it is done.
When Kuroma started at the archives in 2004, Sierra Leone was emerging from civil war. He was fresh out of high school and his parents had died, so he needed the small salary badly. And Kuroma was fascinated by the archives. They date back to 1788 and the first treaty regional leaders made with British colonists.
Most times when I'm in the archives alone, I decided that, oh, one day I want to be a professor, then I would start writing books.
The archives span the years when Africans were forced into slavery and of the era afterward. Colonial administrators filled books with careful descriptions of each enslaved African who was liberated.
Sometimes the unwritten are so bad.
Some descriptions hint at scary, intriguing stories, like how all the women in one ship had burn marks on their breasts. Kuroma doesn't see those stories in any history books.
We have read books, and we have not seen the original things. When they come to the archives, they see the original text, people become amazed.
amazed at the sheer amount of information. In his 15 years at the archives, Abu Kuroma says he's received a lot of visitors, academics and researchers from Europe and North America.
So much of them, they were coming.
More and more of them every year, rushing to catch up with history. Researchers realized technology had become cheap and accessible enough to digitize documents and put information into databases. There was one basic question researchers wanted to answer first. For a long time, historians have struggled to estimate the size of the transatlantic slave trade. So the first big database researchers finished revealed an answer. It's estimated that at least 12.5 million people were abducted from Africa and sold as slaves. As many as 10.7 million survived.
Inevitably, if you're descended from one of the 10.7 million people who survived the Middle Passage, there's going to be a point where there is no more data.
Katrina Kiefer says that's what academics wanted to know next, how to trace enslaved Africans back to their home village or tribe. She recalls thinking about that when she was in grad school. If we knew where enslaved Africans came from, their descendants wouldn't have to have a family history that began with slavery.
And I remember sitting in the classroom and thinking, but the answer's right there. It's literally right there on people's faces.
People's faces. That's what Kiefer focused on. During a teenage obsession with dressing goth, Kiefer had developed a fascination with the physical ways people mark themselves to show identity. That led her to see something others didn't when she looked at colonial British records. Their descriptions, in many cases, include drawings of facial scars made by Africans to show their origins and identities, which, after they were enslaved, served to represent where they came from, what village or ethnic group.
Initially, people kind of blinked at me. There was a lot of, well, yes, of course. Oh my God. Oh, we never thought of that. Oh, why didn't we think of that?
Kiefer's now an adjunct professor of history and cultural studies at Canada's Trent University. She's using information in the Sierra Leone archives to develop a computer program that can recognize and catalog the scars.
We're hoping to essentially allow people to feel a greater connection to their ancestors and a greater realization of what their true origins are.
But then again, a scar can only tell you so much.
Any one data point, like a scar, is great. It's really important, but it's only one data point.
That's why the SCAR database is meant to feed into a massive new information hub that's being created by a team led by Dean Rayberger at Michigan State University.
In doing the project, we found a number of institutions and places that are holding data that people didn't even know about.
The project, named Enslaved, will attempt to gather in one place, a website, research about the historic slave trade. Until now, that information's only been in books or museums or scattered in corners of the internet, in different languages, hidden behind broken links. The Enslaved Project is standardizing all that information, so it'll be searchable and accessible.
It's the first time that this could happen at this scale for the amount of funds we have.
There are critics who point out that the information being gathered is from the point of view of enslavers and colonialists. But institutions around the world are participating. Harvard's contributing a database drawn from 1,500 biographies, edited by Henry Louis Gates Jr. and others. Executive editor Stephen Niven says previously, the information was behind a paywall.
The print set cost about $1,200.
The Enslaved Project is supposed to go online next year, and Niven expects the sudden influx of accessible information to revolutionize the way people learn about slavery and teach it.
By using biographies, and by using a large number of biographies, we can tell complex stories, local stories, to get a grip of what is hard history of, you know, the forced migration of, you know, 12 million people and then systematic exploitation for several hundred years in the Americas.
But that's still just scratching the surface. In Sierra Leone, archivist Abu Kuroma says there's a lot of unexplored history left, history that's at risk of being lost. The original documents in the Sierra Leone archives are being kept in buildings with broken windows, frequent power failures, and no air conditioning. The papers crumble easily.
And most of the pages, if you turn them that much, it will break.
Many of the researchers who visit try to help with money for improvements or to digitize the papers. But Kuroma feels like those efforts usually just sputter out.
They will promise to help the archives. They will do their best to help the archives. But it's normally not enough. We want to keep these things alive because other people have volunteered to keep them alive before us.
Kuroma worries that no one will volunteer to care for the archives after him, since archivists in training earn so little. He believes for the true history of slavery to survive and be told, the original evidence must be preserved and protected. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Before we take a break, here's a quick update on a story we've been following for a while. Today, the former head of the Nissan car company was arrested for a fourth time. Japanese prosecutors say Carlos Ghosn transferred $15 million in Nissan funds over 3 years, and they suspect $5 million of that amount was used by Ghosn for personal spending. Ghosn denies all the allegations against him, and his lawyer, Junichiro Hironaka, says he can't understand why his client was arrested again. Hironaka says prosecutors are tormenting Ghosn through what he calls hostage justice. The ex-Nissan CEO is already facing charges of misstating his salary and misusing company funds. He previously spent 4 months in jail and was out on bail until this morning. Nissan's own internal review of its former exec says there is evidence of wrongdoing and mentions a cult of personality surrounding Ghosn. Carlos Ghosn says his latest arrest is an attempt to break him and calls the accusations against him groundless. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, one of Japan's biggest pop groups features 116 singers. Yep, 116. And the group lets fans vote on which one of them gets to sing lead.
If you don't get enough votes, you vanish into the background. It's like the Mickey Mouse Club meets the Hunger Games.
That's gotta be brutal. That story and more, still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. And I've got The World's Peter Thompson in the studio with me. Hey, Peter.
Hey, Marco.
Peter's our editor and resident expert on all things environmental. In particular, you know a lot about a place called Lake Baikal in Siberia.
I do. It's the largest body of fresh water on the planet, and it's tucked way out there in Siberia, pretty much off the map for most of the world. There's this one gigantic lake that holds roughly a fifth of the world's liquid fresh water, which is roughly as much as all of our North American Great Lakes combined.
Wow.
And it's also home to somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 unique species that live nowhere else on the planet.
And Peter, you know all this in part because you wrote a book on Baikal a while back, Sacred Sea.
Yeah, Sacred Sea, A Journey to Lake Baikal. And one of the big questions I asked in that book was whether Russia could still basically avoid the kind of mistakes with this amazing wild place that we have made here in the West and much of the rest of the world with so many of our amazing wild places.
So, Peter, your book came out in 2007. That's a dozen years ago. Update us on how Russia is doing on that key challenge, keeping Lake Baikal from basically getting wrecked.
Unfortunately, Marco, not so well. Take a listen to this guy.
Right now, Baikal is experiencing very, very hard ecological crisis.
That is Oleg Timoshkin. He's in Irkutsk, which is very close to Baikal, and he's been studying Baikal for almost 40 years. I talked to him earlier this week via Skype, and he told me that the water around much of Baikal's shoreline is experiencing massive algae blooms. And he says those algae blooms have been linked to die-offs in a host of those unique Baikal species.
What's causing those die-offs?
Well, pretty simply, it's us. I mean, there's a growing human footprint along the shoreline, especially from tourism, and there's almost no decent sewage treatment plant anywhere in the region for all those people. Here's how Oleg Timoshkin put it.
All of the sewage purification systems around the lake, they are, how to say, old-fashioned. Second, they are broken for different reasons.
So basically, Marco, nutrients from the sewage from all those people, it's all been pouring into Baikal and essentially serving as fertilizer for all that algae. And just about all this is illegal, by the way. Russia has pretty good laws governing pollution around Baikal. They're just not being enforced.
So what is Russia doing about this?
Well, let me ask you, Marco, what would you do?
Well, I'd start by updating the sewage systems.
Yeah, that might be the common sense approach. But here's the thing. A few weeks ago, the Russian Ministry of Natural Resources released a proposal to address all that illegal sewage, not by cracking down on violations, not by putting money into upgrading sewage treatment plants, but by raising the limits on the amounts of pollution that can be released into the lake.
So they're just kind of moving the goalposts a little bit here. So what does the Ministry of Natural Resources in Russia say in defense of this proposed change?
Well, it's been hard to track down any direct comments from officials, but I have seen a few official documents related to the new rules. There's some standard language in there about the move being supported by scientific research, which Timoshkin tells me is just not true. The bottom line, though, is that even they basically seem to be saying, we're doing this because it's just too expensive to meet the current standards.
Wow. So what might happen now?
Well, despite this coming from a ministry in Putin's government, it may not actually be a sure thing. Timoshkin told me that public comments on the change as of earlier this week were something like 900-0 against it, for what that's worth in Russia. Then there's the question of Putin himself. Baikal is a UN World Heritage Site, and it is one of Russia's real crown jewels. And whether it's out of a genuine love for the place or just a political calculation, Putin has actually been a pretty strong defender of the lake. And so it's possible that even though his own ministry is putting this forward, he might yet put the kibosh on it.
You know, I'm hearing a lot of stories lately, Peter, about the pressure that tourism creates, not just at places like Lake Baikal, but many spots around the globe that tourists want to go to.
Yeah, tourism overload is a really huge problem. I mean, whether you're talking about cities like Venice and Amsterdam, or, you know, supposedly remote wild places like the Galapagos Islands, parts of Antarctica, we are loving them to death. And this is in addition to all the pressures being put on these places by climate change. This is something I wrestled with in writing my book. I was writing about how fragile the place was, but despite all my cautions, I really felt like I was still kind of encouraging people to go there. So, you know, I almost didn't write it, but then I did. And, you know, I'm still not sure that was the right call. But here's the thing, and I'll let Oleg Timoshkin make this last important point.
Baikal is still not killed.
Baikal is still not killed. I mean, the Russian government can still actually take steps to cut down on pollution from tourism and from local communities. And, you know, we have a responsibility here, too. We can make a difference. If people still want to go to places like Baikal, like the Galapagos, like Antarctica, one really important thing they can do is to make sure that the places they stay, the boats they travel on, really abide by the highest environmental standards. Ultimately, it's down to us.
The World's Peter Thompson, the author of Sacred Sea, A Journey to Lake Baikal. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
The idea of a boycott, shunning a brand or product or even a country, it's long been an effective way to make a point about any number of causes. But that word boycott, it comes from one event and one specific man, Charles Cunningham Boycott, a.k.a. Captain Boycott, an Englishman in late 1800s Ireland, when all of Ireland was under English rule, both what we know today as Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. The countryside was populated by poor peasants and rich landlords, and Captain Boycott ended up right in between them. Here's a story from Stan Alcorn, a reporter with our partners Reveal, the investigative podcast and radio show.
Captain Boycott was barely a captain. His parents bought him a spot in the British Army, and he quit after just 2 years at age 20. He spent the rest of his life farming, horse racing, and doing the job that would make him famous, collecting rent as the agent for a landlord who owned 2,000 acres on Ireland's west coast. I wanted to see that land, the stone houses and boggy fields, for myself. But my boss wouldn't pay for the plane ticket. So instead, I started calling up people who live there. And I found a lot of them know the story of Captain Boycott as part of their family history.
Hi, it's Elaine. How you doing?
Elaine Nocton's ancestors were farmers who paid rent to Boycott.
My grandmother used to always say, they were hard times, but nobody knew any better. Because everything was very equal back then. If you were running short of milk one day, you knew you could go to the neighbour and you'd be given milk. And in exchange, you'd give back eggs the following day. Everybody wanted the same thing for everybody else. They just wanted a fair rent.
But what seemed fair to farmers depended on the harvest. And in 1879, the potato crop was the worst in a decade. There were reports of starvation and a fear that the Great Famine that had killed one out of every 10 people in Ireland just a generation earlier was about to repeat itself. So Captain Boycott's tenants got together and sent a message to his mansion, the Loch Mask House, asking him to lower the rent by 25%. Boycott said no, and he had the local process server, that's basically the official court messenger, start serving them with eviction papers. He went house to house with an armed guard of 18 police officers.
What seemed to have kicked it off was when they tried to deliver an eviction, or they did deliver an eviction notice to a widow.
According to the local paper, the widow told them, "You'll not serve my house as long as I have life in my body."
The story goes that she had a red flag, and once she raised the red flag, all the women and children came out from behind the bushes and basically just started pelting the process server with stones and kind of drove them the whole way back to Loch Mask House.
The next day, a crowd of maybe 100 men, women and children swarmed a hill near Boycott's house. It looked like things were about to get violent.
Yeah, and from my understanding, I think Father John O'Malley kept control on that.
If anyone could control the crowd, it was Father John O'Malley, the parish priest whose influence you can see in the rough limestone church he built, where today Father Paddy Gilligan has taken his place.
Keep out the breeze.
On the wall next to the altar, there's a small bronze plaque for Father John O'Malley.
Very simple. He will be forever remembered as a faithful priest and defender of his people's rights in very hard and trying times. And I'd say that that was certainly the mood of the people, you know.
Can you compare the role that he played in the community at that time with the role that you play now?
Well, it would be to contrast rather than compare, I think.
While Father Gilligan speaks gently about building community, Father O'Malley gave fiery speeches warning that landlords wanted to annihilate the Irish people. He was the local leader of a political movement sweeping the Irish countryside called the Land League that saw the fight for the rights of Irish farmers as the first battle in a war for Irish independence. But he didn't want it to be an actual war.
Around that time, there were quite a number of incidents where the agents of landlords who were trying to collect rent were actually murdered. So he tried to persuade them to make their protest, but to make it peacefully.
And he had a specific protest tactic in mind, one that had just been laid out in a speech by the president of the Land League, Charles Stuart Parnell. His speech was reenacted in the 1947 movie Captain Boycott. At the speech's climax, Parnell asked the crowd, "If a landlord evicts a farmer, what should you do if another farmer helps the landlord by taking over the evicted man's lease?"
"I think I heard somebody say, shoot him. There is a very much better way, a more Christian and charitable way. You must shun him. Shun him. On the roadside when you meet him, in the streets of the town, in the shop, on the fair green and in the marketplace, and even in the house of worship, by isolating him from his kind as if he were a leper of old. If you do this, you may depend upon it, there will be no man so lost to shame as to dare to face the cold, accusing finger of public scorn."
Scorn and shunning. These were the weapons of the Land League. And Father O'Malley helped convince his parish to use them on Captain Boycott.
Apparently, he'd be walking down the street and he'd be shunned.
Elaine Nocton again.
No one spoke to him. The postman refused to deliver his post. Every single person participated in it. Like, he was completely left on his own down there.
The blacksmith wouldn't shoe his horses. The baker wouldn't bake him bread. Not only did the farmers refuse to pay him rent for their land, they wouldn't do any work on Captain Boycott's farm, which left him with acres of potatoes and turnips that were about to rot in the ground. Until, in a plot twist in the movie version that also really happened, Boycott wrote a letter to the Times of London, where he found a more sympathetic English audience.
"Extraordinary letter here, Humphrey. Fella called Boycott out in the west of Ireland. Can't get his harvest in.
Seems his laborers have left him in a body.
As Boycott's story spread, 50 British loyalists from Northern Ireland volunteered to come help with the harvest. And the British government chipped in with an armed guard of hundreds of British soldiers.
Didn't I tell you the landlords would fight to the last drop of the other fella's sweat?
Reporters came from all across Europe to watch them dig up Captain Boycott's tubers. The so-called Boycott Relief Expedition worked, but it was expensive.
It made no sense. Like, it's reported to have cost £5,000 to save 500 euros worth of crop.
Boycott couldn't afford another harvest like that. So when the army left, so did he. The shunning had worked.
It was quite simple, but effective.
As Captain Boycott fled, the word boycott was just getting started. Credit for coining it typically goes to two men, Father John O'Malley and James Redpath, an American journalist. According to local lore, it happened a short, muddy walk from Father O'Malley's church in a house that's now a stone ruin covered in lichen and ivy.
Stoop down when you come in.
Joe Graney was born in this house, as was his mother and his grandmother and his great-grandmother.
Now we're going into what used to be the kitchen.
And he believes a great-aunt of his rented a room to Father O'Malley.
And right sitting here in this room, inside that window is where Father O'Malley would sleep. Because that was the bedroom when I was a child where my grandfather and grandmother would sleep. And left of that was a little pantry, we called it, where we left a bag of flour and old wet coats and the dog slept in it, etc., etc. And if you look, there's one stone there at an angle with a lovely little turn on it. That is most likely the stone they were sitting at the day that Father O'Malley used the word.
In Joe's telling, Father O'Malley was talking to the journalist about another landlord, a man named Brown.
Let's get Brown. Let's do what they did to Boycott. Let's do a boycott job on this Brown. That's what we're going to do. We're going to boycott Brown. That's the stone that they were most likely sitting at, exactly at that fireplace in there.
Boycott was catchy. And Father O'Malley saw that by putting it in the newspaper, James Redpath, the journalist, could help it catch on all across the country, like a 19th century hashtag.
He saw him as the modern day Twitter or the then Facebook, where I can get our message from this little village to the world.
Joe Graney there, speaking with reporter Stan Alcorn. Stan's story is from our partners at Reveal, a weekly podcast and radio show from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. Learn what happened after the word boycott was coined. The rest of the story is in the latest episode of Reveal. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. It is still a tough dilemma for the music industry, how to get fans to pay when they're used to listening to stuff for free. No one's quite cracked that. Japan's largest girl group has come up with its own solution by charging fans for unusual access to their favorite stars, things like shaking hands. And now this model is spreading across Asia with big success. Here's the world's Patrick Nguyen.
The biggest pop group in the world is AKB 48! And I mean literally the biggest. AKB 48 has about 116 singers. They make what is called idol music, in-your-face pop cuteness, performed by an army of singers, many of them teenage girls. I want you. The 116 singers, that's just the core group based in Tokyo. That group has five sister groups across Japan. And if you add those up, you get more than 300 singers. This is not just a pop group, it is an empire. And it has expanded beyond Japan, spawning foreign branches, SGO48 in Saigon, SNH48 in Shanghai. And they often sing the same hits in different languages. For example, here's an AKB48 song called Aitakata, or Want to Meet You, sung in Japanese. Here's the version in Filipino, sung by MNL48 from Manila. Here's JKT48 from Jakarta, singing in Indonesian. And finally, BNK48 from Bangkok, singing in Thai. With more than 500 members in 7 countries, you can have concerts all the time. And they do, making tons of money. That alone would be reinventing what a pop group even is. But we barely scratched the surface. Say that song, girl. I wanna hold your hand. Just imagine the height of Beatlemania. Those screaming fans? Okay, imagine John and Paul and George and Ringo had them line up and then charge them money to actually hold their hands. That's what these groups do. They're called handshake events, but...
Yeah, it's more like hand-holding. It's not like proper business handshake. It's basically like holding hands with two hands.
That's Nuttapong Chaiwanitpon. He is a Thai author, 40 years old, living in Japan, and he writes books explaining Japanese culture to foreigners. He says, if you buy one CD, you get a handshake ticket worth about 3 seconds with your favorite singer.
It's like, okay, hello, nice to meet you. My name is, okay, I'm done, gone.
Or you can buy 20 CDs. Then you get a minute with your pop idol.
I think it's a marketing masterstroke. Like, some people just buy like 500 CDs just to get a ticket and they throw the CDs away.
Nuttapong says he went to an event in Bangkok where he shook the hand of a BNK48 singer.
She just asks my name and she's just like, please support me and saying, yeah, I love you and stuff like that.
I love you.
Yeah, I was surprised when she said it. Oh, well, okay.
But there's a reason she would say that. Inside each group, there's a constant war for supremacy, to build up more of your own fans than your bandmates have. Because the other power that fans get when buying a CD is the right to vote on who will get to sing on the next smash hit. If you don't get enough votes, you vanish into the background. It's like the Mickey Mouse Club meets the Hunger Games. BNK48, their most popular singer, named Cheprang, she once described this process as brutality. It's like we have to slaughter our own friends, she says, in this authorized BNK48 documentary. It sounds really intimidating, and yet there are teenagers across Asia clamoring to join these groups.
Hello, modeling people. I'm Shaki, 17 years old. I'm powerful stage queen.
This is a typical audition video. It's for the Manila group, MNL48. And this young woman, Shaky, is showing off her singing.
1, 2, 3, come on. You got me feeling the emotion inside.
And she made the cut. All the different groups, they have their own vibe. In the Catholic Philippines, they'll throw in some gospel songs. In Jakarta, a mostly Muslim city, JKT48 will not shake hands with the left hand because it's seen as unclean. BNK48 in Bangkok, they are very silly and sanuk, a Thai concept meaning carefree fun. But are they actually carefree? Probably not. It's a demanding job. 6-year contracts, no unauthorized social media posts, and no boyfriends, because some of the male fans don't like it. Cheprang, the top star, when she joined the group, she had to dump her boyfriend. We broke up, she says, and I was sobbing. This is a serious rule. One time an AKB48 member got caught dating a guy, and she had to apologize by shaving her head. This isn't like being in a wild and crazy rock band, Nuttapong says. You are a manicured product, created to make the fans happy at all costs.
You cannot do this, you cannot do that, you cannot say this, you cannot say that.
So maybe you're wondering, is this wrong to incentivize teenagers to, you know, slaughter their friends for fame? Or have them hold hands with strangers, some of them men who are much older? I tried to ask the members of BNK48 directly. Talked to their agents for months, trying to arrange an interview. It never worked out. Not that they need the extra attention. They're not just selling CDs and handshakes. You can't go outside in Bangkok without hearing an ad with BNK48 selling perfume or Toyotas or this ad selling soy milk. And all the while, the empire keeps expanding.
MUM48 is a launchpad to your dreams.
Get ready, India. The latest group is MUM48 in Mumbai, now taking applications.
So girls, spread your wings and soar the skies with this opportunity.
For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
This is not MUM48. They're still in auditions. This is BNK48 from Thailand.
PRI, Public Radio International.